tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to Window C, recorded live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Broadcast live on Full Service Radio and presented by Amyla, Adams Morgan Youth Leadership Academy. I'm Chris Price.
Back from Jamaica.
That's right. Hopefully a little
from
darker.
The islands.
Man. Hopefully a little darker.
Hopefully, you got to hit you with that horn.
Hopefully my eyes still aren't red or nothing crazy. Today we are blessed to have a guest who came through and met with us a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And told us a little bit about his story, his journey, his experiences. And I think he's good to have on the show because he can add context to a lot of conversation we've been having about drugs and the effects, so we can give you both sides.
Right.
You know, the last time I was here, I was talking about which drugs I missed out on. So
that's interesting.
and also the positive effects that drugs can have.
Yeah, that was actually really interesting too. Mm-hmm. So if you're new to this podcast, check out some past episodes because I had no clue about the positive aspect of drugs, well, MDMA specifically, and how it's helping traumatized soldiers. But we're gonna get into Mr. Samuel Bugs and his story. A local to this area, and sound like you did a lot as well.
Yeah, I definitely have, as far as drugs are concerned. You know, as I mentioned the last time I was here, you know, I began using drugs in 1973 while at the age of 12. Assuming there was no harm in my smoking a little marijuana and drinking a little beer, wine at the time, and not having any clue as to what it would eventually lead to.
So I don't know if I stopped you last time. You said at the age of 12. How the hell does somebody
at 12
get into drugs at 12?
Yeah.
And you have kids now. I mean, at that age, right down to date. Smoking marijuana or even that other crazy, that K2 or whatever they call it. They doing it now. So,
but how did it happen to you? Like, what were you doing? Do you remember the first time you smoked?
Yeah, I do. I was, I just moved from Southeast Washington, D.C. to Landover, Maryland, Kentland. Mm-hmm. And for some peculiar reason, that's when a lot of my problems began. And I was at an age, at being at 12, I was curious about a number of things. I was willing to experiment with different things, man, and drugs being one of those things. And I began simply because playing basketball at that time, there were a number of people that were doing it. Mm-hmm. It was doing exactly that. And some of them were older than I was, but there were a great deal that, a number of them that were my age.
You mean guys you met on the basketball court, or they were literally smoking on the basketball court?
Well, not literally smoking on the basketball court, because basketball, we would run them down the court. But that's what we would do, is like say like once we, in between games, or after playing hours of running up and down the basketball court, I guess that was our way of relaxing and releasing the tension or stress that may have built up, you know, during the basketball game.
Y'all was just trying to get high.
Yeah, we just trying to get twisted, you know?
You know what's funny? I'm thinking about my childhood in the basketball court I grew up on. They used to gamble on us. Mm. Like, I was never called my name. I was always Jit. I was always Pearl's nephew because my aunt in South Florida lit up South Florida in basketball. Everybody know her. So I'm Pearl's nephew down there. But the older guys, they used to gamble on the courts. Mm. And the cops used to come by and they used to scatter like bugs. And it used to happen religiously.
Everything happened on the basketball court.
Yeah. But you know what? The surrounding at this particular basketball court, once again, it was in Landover, in Kentland. It was in sort of like a park area. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had this basketball court. You had nothing other than that but trees, grass, a little creek. And anybody that approached that basketball court, you could see them from a distance approaching. And we gambled down there also. We did a number of things, but for the most part, it was a lot of basketball playing, a lot of beer, wine drinking, and smoking marijuana.
How long did it take before you graduated to a more serious drug?
Well, you know what? It was kind of like a progressional thing. because again, I started with marijuana and drinking beer and wine. Then before I knew it, I began to experiment with acid, angel dust at that time, mushrooms, pills, and I believe even cough syrup until I reached the age, by the time I reached the age of 16, I began shooting heroin.
Was there ever anyone in your life to tell you, don't do this?
Oh, of course. I mean, my parents, man, and you know what, despite all that I've gone through, my parents provided every situation, opportunity to see that I avoided the things I eventually found myself into. And with me personally, the calling of the streets. My so-called friends at that time had a great influence over me than parental guidance I was receiving at home.
When did your parents learn that you were doing drugs?
You know what? For the most part, my parents were pretty much naive about drug usage. Neither my father drank. My mother drank on occasions. My mother didn't have any experiences that I personally know of. And one of the reasons I later found out had to do with a cousin of mine that was from New York that had heroin habit in the mid-late 60s. And she seen him go through heroin withdrawals. And she related that experience to the uses of drugs. So she never engaged. And I'm not sure when this happened, but I think by the time I was like 16, I discovered marijuana in my father's closet. I was more surprised than anything else because I had no idea that my father was smoking marijuana. Of course, I took a little bit, but I had no idea. But you know what? My father never gave the impression that he had anything to do with the drugs and that he drank. But the amazing thing about my father was sort of like a weekend drinker. He didn't drink during the weekday because he worked at the time in the sanitation department. And eventually he worked at the sanitation department in D.C., and drove a cab. So, you know, he worked fairly hard.
I would think between the ages of 12 and 16, you're using these drugs, your parents would see a change in your behavior, your attitude. That didn't keep, you know, that wasn't something that happened where they would ask you what's going on, why you acting this way.
Or did your grades slip or anything happen?
Something.
Well, my grades were never that great from the beginning, if I would be totally honest. I think the best grades I got during that time was in kindergarten. And from kindergarten,
he said my grades never had a chance to slip.
You know, it really did. So there was anything to notice at that time with my, as far as my grades concerned. And as far as they're noticing my uses of drugs, I think they had no base from which to examine or compare. Mm-hmm. You know, my drug use. Well, Sam looks. Looking like so and so, because I remember when so and so was using drugs. They really had nothing to gauge my behavior against someone that they knew that were or that was using drugs. And I mean, when I got high, and whenever I came in the house, I separated myself. I immediately went to my room. So it wasn't like I was smoking marijuana or drinking beer, and I'm twisted and. You know, I won't be in front of the family and looking strange and feeling strange. No, I wasn't anything like that, man. I pretty much separated myself.
From 12 to 16.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, where do you get the money for drugs?
Well, you know, that kind of like began my criminal activities. Because as you pointed out, I mean, you got pretty much buy the drugs that you choose to use. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were a couple of things that was going on with me at that time. Most of the guys that I chose to be around were slightly older than I was. So perhaps I believe at that time their criminal behavior may have been more than mine at that time, but I eventually began to do the same thing that they were doing. That basically, I was stealing. And it was basically since I had no other responsibilities as far as payment. You know, whatever money I got, then we received an allowance. My parents always seen every other week we would receive, I think, $10, I think, a week. And it didn't take me long to spend mine because I knew exactly where to go to spend it. So, yeah. But you know what, man? It's just amazing. Oftentimes now, for those of you who don't know, I'm 61 years old. So at times I find myself really fascinated by the things that I've done in my past. Some of which is hard to me for me to believe, to absorb.
Like what? What are some of those things?
Well, one of the things is that, you know, I've always been afraid of needles. Right now today, I'm afraid of needles. When they want to draw my blood, I have to stick my arm out and turn my head. And that's what I did when I began shooting, allowing someone to place an hypodermic needle in my arm in order to receive, heroin. And, you know, that's what I did for a number of years. Once I got to the point of shooting heroin, that's what I did. I always stuck my arm out and I turned my head because I didn't want to, you know. And I still had that phobia right now in the day, the amazing thing. And, you know, that really began an abrupt change in my life. Once I began shooting heroin, and I basically only did that on the weekends. I would sneak out the house. You know, unbeknownst to everyone with the exception of my brother and I shared a room, and when it was time for me to sneak back in the house, I would have to wake him up in order to allow me inside. But, man, it's just crazy, man, looking back on it. But, you know, I did those things, man. Again, for me, the power of peer pressure, man, really compelled me to do a number of things. And I know pretty much for a fact I probably wouldn't have done if it had not been for the influence of my social crowd at that time.
I felt the need to...
to impress, to feel better about myself. All those things. And another thing I discovered probably soon after I began using marijuana, it changed me. There was an emotional, I think a psychological change that I went through that allowed me to be more comfortable with my self-perception of myself.
Marijuana changed you?
Yeah, I mean drugs in period.
So you kind of became dependent on that feeling?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And I sorted it out with every opportunity that I had. And I wasn't conscious of it at that time, but I can look back now and remember like going to dances, being in junior high school and high school, going to dance before we went into anything like that. We got high. And I felt it was necessary for me to get high at those times because it allowed me to be the person that I wanted to become. I was fairly introverted, shy, lack of self-confidence, self-esteem, and all of those things. Oh, excuse me. So, my using drugs was a way out of that. You know, when I used drugs, when I smoked marijuana, no matter what it was, marijuana, drinking, or dropping acid, or whatever it was, I changed.
Did it get to a point where you felt like marijuana wasn't enough? Like you wanted to get higher?
His weed a gateway drug?
No doubt. No doubt, man. It's my personal opinion. I know there are a number of people that may disagree with that. Mm-hmm. But from my own personal experiences, I believe that marijuana had been, in my life anyway, a gateway drug. Because one thing I discovered, man, I started out smoking little paper joints.
Right.
And what I eventually knew and understood that the more I did it, the more it took me to get where I wanted to be. So those joints became larger and larger and larger. And, at that time, I think a nickel bag was like, wow. It was quite a bit.
If you see his fingers, y'all, yeah. About an inch and a half apart.
Yo, yeah, that blew everybody.
It was pretty much like that. You got a lot for $5, yeah.
Well, how many years did you end up spending in jail total?
25 years, and it was directly due to my drug use, in particular my heroin use, because, again, I only did it initially during the weekend. Mm-hmm. I would sneak out of the house, meet up with some friends of mine that were older than I was, And we, in D.C., we would go down either on, we would go up to the line up on C. Pleasant on the line.
Not this line, y'all.
Not this line. But the D.C. and Maryland line up in C. Pleasant, for those of you that are familiar with that area, it used to be the Jumbo at that time. And it was a lot of drug activity at that time there. Or we would either go to Barnett's, which was a little bar, nightclub, restaurant, right off of Division Avenue, and if we really had transportation or had a desire, we'd go to 7th Street, because after I began shooting heroin, I began shooting BAM soon after. And for those of you who have no idea what BAM is, BAM was a pollutant. It was a weight reduction pill that at that time was highly used in D.C. And at Barnett's, it was $7 a piece. If we chose to go down to 7th Street, we can get it for $3.
How do people figure out that these things will get you high? Like, I wonder who was the first person that said, let's try BAM.
Yeah. Hey, but imagine the same question being placed towards crack. I mean, in my mind, man, crack was probably one of the most amazing drugs in relation to what it does, not only to people in particular, but I think it changed our whole culture. It changed society as a whole, man. Bam. I mean, the introduction of crack to so-called urban areas. Decimate. And eventually, yeah, it was a lot of destructive natures involved with crack, man. It changed the family structure. It changed how a lot of people thought. It changed how a lot of people thought of themselves and the world and the environment in general. It just changed so much, man. I think to the point where you can still see remnants of that even today. Man, crack was an amazing drug, which I, of course, experimented with after my first incarceration, which was 15 years. I wasn't home 24 hours, man, and I was exposed to crack cocaine. No clue what it would eventually get me into.
If you're just joining us, you're listening in a window seat. We're talking to Mr. Samuel Bugs about his story. There's a lot going on here. Drug use, prison.
It sure was.
And you know what's funny? I want to get sidetracked just for like 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Bill Cosby's life is going to be like after being labeled a sex offender?
Yeah.
And he's 81 and he's in jail.
Yeah. I feel for him. I know I heard over TV that O.J. Simpson presumed that Bill Cosby would have problems because he was declared a rapist or a sexual predator or whatever. I feel for the man, because you know what, man? All things being equal, I look at what Bill Cosby has done or have been accused of doing. Man, this society, I mean, there's still a number of people. Our illustrious president has been accused on multiple occasions about his sexual offenses. Man, a number of Hollywood producers and actors and all these. And none of these people, as of yet, have been charged and convicted and eventually sent to jail.
Right.
One thing I do remember about Mr. Cosby's situation, I remember within a year prior to that, there were reports that Mr. Cosby had, him and some associates, had intentions of buying NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know whether there's a correlation, but one thing I do remember about Hollywood, man, I know oftentimes, because I'm a TV fanatic, I watch a lot of TV all my life. I've been involved in watching TV. And I still recall the little whispers about the so-called casting couch.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. So, I mean, not saying it's definitely not right, because wrong is wrong no matter how you look at it. But a lot of things that Mr. Cosby and some of these other people have been accused of, it was pretty much common practice, unfortunately. Not only in Hollywood and places like that, man, but, you know, you find a lot of people that are sensitive to their desires. In other words, man, if you want something bad enough, there's normally a barometer, there's normally boundaries that you will or will not cross. And unfortunately, man, I feel for him. I really do.
Does his celebrity, is that going to make his experience in jail harder? Or is it the charges that were brought about? You know, is he going to be protected? Is he going to have the same experience that anybody would have if they came in, you know, for robbery because he's Bill Cosby? Like,
Does it hurt or help that he has money?
Well, you know what? I think it depends on the environment that he's in. Currently, I believe he's in the maximum security jail in Philadelphia. And he's supposed to be, I believe he's isolated. He has his own single confines. They said eventually he may be allowed to be moved to a more, less structured environment. Mm-hmm. And I think it depends on the persons that may be there incarcerated also. You know, as some of you probably already know, there are a great deal of people of color within, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of these jails throughout the country, man. And I think I think he'd be highly respected.
I hope so. And I just don't wish bad on anyone.
Yeah.
But I don't want to talk about his story too much because I'm going to end up saying
it. Kind of sensitive, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little too much going on.
It is, man. It really is. But you know what? The thing I'm committed to doing with myself, man, no matter what biases, and we all have them, or opinions I have, man, I try to see things clearly and appropriately. And, you know, with that, having said that, with my understanding of a number of things within in this country, man, you know, I have to consider those things too, whatever they may be.
Is there something that you believe could have changed the direction of your life before you got into prison?
You know what, man? The strange thing is, I was born in 1957, so I came up in the latter part of the 50s and the 60s. At that time, man, there were so many things that a lot of parents weren't aware of, and I'm talking about human development. Now, since I've had the benefit of some college, I know now the importance of granting a child, even a baby, an infant, certain, I'll say, ingredients in order to hopefully have that person grow into a so-called a normal adult.
Right.
And if those things aren't done, scientists and sociologists now understand that those things aren't done, the likelihood of that person going astray from what we call so-called normal people are fairly prevalent, man. And so it's important. And what I'm talking about is that we now know and understand that if a young child isn't given confidence, like by telling a little kid, yeah, you can do it, you can do it. You know, those sorts of things. Now, for years, that seemed like, you know, why would I need to do that? But now we understand the importance of that. And that grows, and that instills self-confidence in a person, being told those things, or allowing the kid to be confronted with challenges and allowing that kid to handle those situations themselves. It allows them to kind of be self-sufficient as much as mm-hmm. possible. So, having said that, man, my situation, man, my parents had no idea about those things. So, when I was a young kid, man, I was always self-absorbing. I felt insecure oftentimes. I felt inadequate. And a lot of times, in a lot of environments, I felt out of place. And to supplant those feelings, man, once I discovered drugs, that was the way, you know, because once again, man, when I smoked marijuana, there was an emotional and psychological change that occurred within myself. And at that time, I didn't know what was going on, but I did recognize this. I knew that I felt a lot more comfortable about my self-image. And, man, for the good part of my life, man, I suffered from those things, man. And, you know, until I got to the point I became older and I began to experience some of the things I've experienced being in those drug-infested areas and eventually prison, man. A lot of that changed because change was necessary in order to survive those environments, man. And
Was it easier for you, each time you came out of prison, was it easier or harder for you to return to using drugs? Because I would think when you get locked up, you can't use drugs. So
that's not wrong ass. No, wrong ass.
Yo, my uncle used to throw drugs in a tennis ball over the jail wall.
Yeah.
For my other uncle.
Man, look, man. In prisons right now today, you have people receiving drugs through possible visits. I don't really want to expose anything.
No, you gotta tell us. You gotta tell us. We got listeners. They want to know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people receive drugs. You have employees of that institution and penitentiary bringing drugs in, because like right now, just for an example, man, a pack of cigarettes. Now, I know my last incarceration in 2008, a pack of cigarettes was like $25-$50 a pack. Damn. So if you can imagine that,
that's the markup.
Yeah, pretty much, because they sell them for like anywhere from, at that time, this was a few years ago, $3 to $5 a cigarette. So if you can make that comparison between cigarettes and drugs, you can just imagine. Now, I remember once again that, because I used heroin while I was incarcerated, but you would receive a matchbook head, if you can imagine that. A matchbook head. I'm just talking about the white part or the green part, mm-hmm. whatever the match head color is. That's what you receive for $10.
Okay. Of heroin.
Of heroin. And if you got an average bag of heroin, man, you might be able to get 20, 30 of those.
Was there ever a break then from the point that you were 12 to whenever you got completely sober, that you didn't use drugs, a year or two where you said, I'm going to go clean, and you weren't successful?
Not by design. I mean, there were times, man, where I began to realize how complicated drugs made my life. But a complete change came during my last incarceration, man, and I began to experience things I had never experienced in my life. I still remember being in Fairfax County Detention Center, and I'm laying on my bunk, and I'm just, my hands behind my head looking at the ceiling. Ooh, excuse me. Then all of a sudden, it seemed as if the walls were closing in on me. I had never had that experience in my life.
Were you high?
No. Quite sober. Probably at that time, too sober. But, you know, I began to experience that, and I still remember right now to this day, when that feeling, that sensation came over me, there was a little slot in the door, in the middle of the door, and I remember trying to place as much as my body through that little hole. And it was maybe about 16, 18 inches long, but only like, man, maybe about 5 or 6 inches across. And man, it just, the wall just seemed to have closed in on me. I remember being on the top tier. And at this, and Fairfax, it was like it was bottom floor, and it was a floor above that. And I remember just looking over, man, looking down below me, man. I said, man, I thought about jumping off. And I wouldn't have probably killed myself because the distance wasn't that great. But again, I never had experienced those feelings in my previous 23, 24 years of incarceration.
We're up on a break. We're going to take a quick break. This is Window Seat. That's all. That's all I'm going to say. That's all.
Service Radio.
Welcome back to Window Seat. We're here with Mr. Samuel Bugs talking about his experiences with drugs, incarceration, and redemption.
Mm, no doubt. And spiritual, to me, it sounded like a spiritual.
Yeah, we left off. You were talking about your experience in prison that led you to get clean.
Well, yeah, that was my last incarceration, which was like in 2008. I came home October 31st, 2010, and... during that those experiences, I had those two and a half years, I knew I couldn't do this anymore. At that time, I was like 54, 55, and all of a sudden, I became my worst fear. Ever since I began going through jails and penitentiaries, my greatest fear was becoming an old man in somebody's jail or institution. And there I was in 2008, and I was just that. I ain't become, I was. I was 54, 55 years old, and actually a little younger. I was about 52, 53. But I felt that I was truly out of place at that time, despite all the time I spent incarcerated. Because I still vividly remember, man, doing my first incarcerations, older guys were severely mistreated. I still remember one guy in particular. I was in the Baltimore Penitentiary, man. There was this old white guy there that had been locked up at that time. I think he got locked up in the early 60s or late 50s or something like that. And, man, they used to treat this man as some kind of terrible. And that image always stuck in my head to the point where I didn't want to become that. I didn't want to become vulnerable enough where people would be able to treat me like that without any resistance.
What kind of things would happen to this man?
I mean, they were kicking him, man. They were just mistreated. I mean, you know, I mean, and he had mental health issues, obviously. He had mental health issues. And they made his situation even worse than what it actually was because of the mistreatment that he was receiving.
Were you ever mistreated when you were in prison?
You know, I've been fortunate, man. I mean, not fortunate. I've been blessed. You know, during the time during my incarceration, I've been stabbed on three different occasions, multiple times. I've been stabbed in the head with a screwdriver, hit my skeleton, tip of the screwdriver broke off of my head. I've been stabbed in the neck, shoulder, back, legs.
Yes, you've been mistreated.
That's the first time I've ever heard somebody say I'm blessed and talk about how many times they've been stabbed.
Hey, but it's real though, man. But see, but at that time, man, I was so disturbed that I thought it was all on my own devices. I'm thinking to myself, yeah, you can't kill me. And it was normally because I had done something I had no business doing. I ran up a drug bill that I had no intentions of paying. When it came time to pay whatever money I had, I was going to buy me some more drugs. I got stabbed in the cut. Me and the guy stabbed each other in the Maryland House of Correction. And 1981, 82, behind my taking marijuana. I mean, a lot of 4 ounces, you'll be surprised. 4 ounces of marijuana on everything I love. 4 ounces of marijuana. And I stole it. Eventually, they found out that I stole it. So naturally, like on all things in life, there are consequences. And eventually, Time came a time and point where he and I were stabbing each other in the middle of the dormitory. I also, the guys attempted to burn me up while in my cell, just during the same incident because I was placed on segregation at that time. And some friends of his were aware of the fact that I was there. And they attempted to burn me up in my cell. But again, it wasn't on my own devices that I overcome, survived those things, man. I mean, you know what, again, I'm not, even now, and I'm not a very religious person, but I am spiritual, so I believe in God. And I know now, at this time, at this very moment, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it was God that was protecting me through all of those things. Because, you know, a lot of people don't survive, man. I mean, not only my drug uses, man, but my encounters and while being incarcerated, man, You know, I've seen so many people succumb to the prison and institutional environments. I've seen guys stabbed to death. I've seen guys running them down a dormitory because someone had thrown a flammable fluid on them. And I've seen guys hang themselves. Man, I smelt burning flesh in the Baltimore penitentiary with some guys in penitentiary threw some a flammable fluid on some guys. And I'll never forget their screams and the smell of burning flesh, because when they came, when the fire was eventually put out or whatever, they had a difficult time getting into, but they had to scrape them with a shovel. And you just see some really horrific things, man. But you know what, man? God was with me. There's no way in the world I can deny it at this point.
Did you ever get therapy?
No, but you know, actually I had, because I went to in 1977, I left the Baltimore Penitentiary and I went down in Jessup, Patuxent, the Patuxent Institution.
How many different institutions were you in, Mr.
Man, Martin? You know what? I never really thought of counting about it, man, but quite a few. Now, again, my first incarceration, pretty much 15 years. During that time, I never stayed in one place more than 4 years. And then oftentimes you transfer because of your behaviors. I mean, you might be in a lower security institution, do something, you're sent to a higher security level. So there have been quite a few, man, especially in the state of Maryland, man. There was a time where I've been in pretty much every jail in the state of Maryland. But in 1977, I left the Baltimore Penitentiary and I was sent to the Patuxent Institution. Now, the Patuxent Institution was allegedly for people, those that were criminally insane, whatever that means. I felt blessed and grateful that I was sent there, because I know that our first day, and I'll never forget this, our first day coming to Patuxent, after leaving a place like the Baltimore Penitentiary, where perhaps your best meal may be Sunday at lunchtime, you might get a pork chop, a scoop of potatoes, and maybe some peas. We came in Patuxent that very first day, man, and we had fresh fish. I mean, it was a whole fish. And I still remember coming in.
You still remember. You look happy.
I really do. I really do. I thought I had died and gone to heaven, man. Because the food in the penitentiary at that time was so horrible, man. You couldn't eat it. I mean, if you didn't have any choice, of course you ate it. But most people lived off the commissary and guys selling, that worked in the kitchen, them selling sandwiches. That was a lot more appetizing than what they served on the line. But coming in Patuxent for that first meal that day, yeah. I was not only the only one that was thoroughly impressed. Mm-hmm. Everyone that came from the Baltimore Penitentiary seeing that big old piece of fish on that tray, yeah, yeah, it was a blessing. But the dietary was a lot better in down Patuxent than the penitentiary. But there, I've also had the benefit of group counseling and psychotherapy, man. And it helped me a lot. I mean, you know what, man? Patuxent helped me so much. It gave me a greater understanding of not only of myself, but life in particular. And, man, my experiences, I stayed down in Patuxent 4.5 years. They're probably, especially during my incarceration, they're probably no greater experience than the experiences that I had down in Patuxent. I mean, they had some of the leading psychologists in the country, if not the world, working there. And I've had the benefit of a number of people that, but you know what? During that time, man, my self-confidence grew. A better understanding of who Samuel Bugs was grew. And in general, my understanding of life, man, grew tremendously. And it was a great benefit.
What was the moment that you decided that you were done?
Again, my last incarceration, man, I realized I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't stand being incarcerated anymore. I couldn't stand being confined anymore. I could no longer stand the consequences of my actions. And during one of those aha moments during the two and a half years during my last incarceration, it simply dawned on me that my life experiences were pretty much three-pronged. I used drugs. I commit crimes, I end up eventually in somebody's jail. That had been my life for the greater part of my young young adulthood. So I knew, I knew that in order to stop going to prison, man, I had to find some way, somehow, to stop using drugs. And when I was released in October 31st, 2010, I had a different mindset. Although I used drugs on occasion, I didn't commit any more crimes.
So how did you get yourself clean? Is there someone you went and saw? Or?
Well, you know what? I would not claim it as my doing. I've been helped, man, right down the street here on Columbia Road, man. 1770 Columbia Road is a place called Christ's House. And it's for people who have medical situations that don't necessarily have any place to heal. I mean, you could be homeless or whatever, have a broken leg, and it's time to be released from the hospital. They would send you to a place like Christ's House, man. And you know what? Spiritually, once again, all I know is this. Once I walked through the threshold of Christ, that door of Christ's House, I had no longer had any desire, wanting, or nor have I used since that time. And this is, 2012, March the 21st.
I don't know. There's a lot. I'm kind of curious, and we have to wrap up in a second, but what was the difference? Because you said Patuxent. You said that experience was completely different than every experience you had before. So if I put you in charge of the jail system, mm-hmm. right, and we want to get people in and out, what would you change to help facilitate that? How would you make that work?
Well, you know what? When I first became incarcerated, just about every jail's name or in their brochure, they had rehabilitation. They talk about rehabilitation. And rehabilitation means to do over again.
I didn't know jails had brochures.
Well, I mean, you know, they're not necessarily brochures. Brochure is a nice way of describing the situation or the circumstances you're about to encounter.
Yeah.
And yeah, they have. I mean, you can probably go on a website and pull up any jail in this area in Maryland, and they'll give you a brief description of what, you know, what they do, what they stand for, and their ideology and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. But what I would change, man, prisons has strictly become about punishment now. There aren't a lot of rehabilitative things that are in you'll find in these jails and institutions now. I've had the benefit of not only securing my GED, but I began my college courses down in Patuxent. They've taken out the possibility, the opportunity of going to college now. There were a lot of things when I first began, like being down at Lorton Youth Center was the first jail I entered. There was a lot of things, man. You had a GED program. You had a number of things that would help persons if they chose to be somewhat better than they were prior to coming in. Those situations and circumstances just don't exist now. It's strictly about punishment.
What do you think about people, especially kids, who sensationalize drugs and going to jail?
Man, they just don't know, man. They don't know. If you don't know any better, you don't do any better. And that's the unfortunate thing with a lot of young people in so-called urban areas, man. You know what? Even when I was coming, I think it's still prevalent today. And in a lot of areas, particularly urban areas, man, we have a way of sensationalizing certain people.
Right.
Drug people sell on the corner selling drugs because we like the way they look. We like the clothes they have. We may even like the car that they drive. But what we don't realize and accept is there are consequences to those things, man. I remember some of y'all probably know the guy, Rayford Edmonds. Mm-hmm. I still recall an interview he did after he received all the time he had and he was incarcerated. He stated that he would be willing to give back every dollar he had ever earned. And he was supposed to be probably the most prolific drug dealer.
In this area.
Yeah. He said he would give it all back if he had an opportunity to walk through that gate. And be free. Man, I tell you, there's a major consequence to a lot of the things. But see, young people don't realize that.
You have people that'll go to jail, though, and come home and still talk about it like it was a good thing. They're not as honest as you are about the experiences that are in jail.
Hey, but you know
I think some people believe going to jail is just a part of becoming a man.
Right, like,
you know so many people that's going to jail. If you're in the right area, you know so many people, like, you just figure that's some shit you're going
to
do.
It's the next thing that in order to grow, you got to go to jail.
But see, that's the wrong message, man, because that's not necessary. It's more of a detractor than anything else. Because what a lot of them don't realize, particularly young people, man, once you mark or labeled a felon,
it's tough.
It has an effect on the rest of your life. You know, and that, but they don't think, a lot of times, man, we do things impulsively, or we do things simply because we think they're a good thing to do at the time. But man, if you take the time to really think out the pros and the cons of your acts, a lot of things probably wouldn't be done. But the problem with a lot of young people, most of the people in their environment are people who've committed crimes, they've even selling drugs or that sort of thing. So unfortunately, those people are glorified in certain areas, man. So again, if you don't know any better, man, you don't do any better.
Can you take a little bit of time and talk about the work that you're doing now?
Oh, man. You know what? I'm so pleased about that. I'm one of the buildings I live in is owned by Jubilee Housing. And Jubilee Housing is a nonprofit affordable housing organization that provides affordable housing right here in the Mount Pleasant area, Adams Morgan Mount Pleasant area. And currently we have like 11 properties. We just purchased 2 other properties, so eventually Jubilee Housing will possess own 13 housing complexes. And I say we because I'm fortunate enough to sit on the board of directors.
That's awesome.
And secretary. And it's an enriching feeling for me personally to be a part of an organization, a group that does that. I'm currently still in the Kairos program, which is a program, long-term treatment program through Christ House. And I say, I'm kind of like in transition because I'm waiting to move. And although I live in one of Jubilee housing properties currently, those floors are occupied by guys in the Kairos program, which is again through Christ House. But I'm waiting for a property they are currently redeveloping. I'm waiting till the completion of that so I can move there. But in addition to that, man, I'm a student at Catholic University. I have class this evening, midterms. And, man, I'm due to graduate next May. And I plan to continue there, man. After I received my degree, man. But you know what, man? I'm doing so many things now that I couldn't even envision doing just 7 short years ago. And the enriching thing about what I'm doing now, although you can never undo what you've done, it helps me to feel a little better about those situations. But you know what? I think a lot of what I've encountered, a lot of what I've endured, make me the person I am now, and I like me today. And that's enriching to me. I like myself today. I like my self-narrative. I like the things I'm doing. Now, you know what, man? And the crazy thing is, I have the trust of a number of people because of my encounters and my interaction with them. And I realized, man, that trust is something that you just don't arbitrarily receive. Mm-hmm. It's something that you build upon. So I've created a number of relationships in this community, even up on Capitol Hill and at the Wilson Building, because of my interaction with people on Congress and the D.C. Council, man. I just love what I'm doing now. But I'm not finished, man. There are a lot of things I still want to do, man. I want to be in a position to affect positive change, not only in this neighborhood, this community, this city, man, but this country, man. And I think we all have the ability to do that. Unfortunately, I got a late start because of my drug usage and my incarceration.
It's never too late, as they say.
Never too late.
I think the growth is all that we're here for. You know, to be the best version of ourselves that we can be.
No doubt.
And so you're talking about a lot of growth, yeah, and it's awesome.
It is, man. But I'm blessed once again. I take no ownership of anything I've been able to do, in particular the last few years, man. They're just blessings. And I choose never to take it for granted. Like even waking up in the morning. I remember when I was young, man, I just knew. I go to sleep at night and I was due to wake up the next morning. I take every day, every moment of my existence. I'm blessed.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for giving us your time, especially on a day like this when you have success. I know how that goes. Yeah, and yeah. I also liked the organizations you talked about. Yeah. Christ House, it sounds like they're doing very important work.
They really are.
The
Jubilee Housing.
Yeah. So if you're listening and you get a chance, Google those organizations, because I can't tell you whatever their URL is, but it's good people out here that like to give money and stuff like that.
I would like to say, if I'd be remiss for not stating this, the pastor, Alan Getchens, and his wife, Dr. Getchens, which is his wife, mm-hmm. was one of the persons that started Unity Healthcare. And if you're familiar with this city, you know about Unity Healthcare. And I just wanted to say one of the most compelling, nicest persons I've ever encountered in my life. This is a really, really special woman, man, and she has a tendency of affecting everyone that she comes in contact with. Okay, really special woman.
Well, tell her we're going to reach out to her. We're going to hear her story, too.
I'm pretty sure she,
All right. Well, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for sharing your time.
Well, I'm grateful for this opportunity, man. Hopefully someone finds some use of what I had to say, man. But lastly, I would just like to say, by no means was I attempting to glorify anything that I've done. So I definitely wouldn't advise it. So, man, it's just a blessing, though.
That's our show.
Hey, thank you, guys.